Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Chauncey Brown, and today is part two of Why Liberal Leaders Lie. My co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler, is in the studio. I'm briefly going to go over the description of the show that we put up on our Blog Talk Radio before we begin. Part two is about Power of the Moral Storm, a 1940 movie, The Moral Storm, starring James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, depicts the early days of Nazi occupation of Austria. Political correctness and campus speech codes are introduced in a college class formerly committed to tolerance of opinion. Gradually, free thought and expression are extinguished, and Stewart and Sylvan must escape a world gone stark, raving mad across in this hospitable alpine pass to a neutral Switzerland. Don't let it happen here. There is no Switzerland to run to. If the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee were not after the truth, what are they after? Many more than suspected the answer. It was power. But they didn't ask what that meant and what grave global danger it might now pose. America's founders knew the answer. All but overlooked in the history books is the way they worried endlessly about the awful influence of power on human affairs. Steeped in the lesson of history, they understood that power was the sworn enemy of liberty. Not content to rely on fine parchment barriers, they separated powers into three independent departments of government so as to make power a check on itself. Then they devised a complex web of checks and balances so they might secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity as never before. Americans need to retrieve the founders' indispensable frame of mind. We welcome to the show again our co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler. How are you this evening, sir?
I'm fine. And you just summarized, repeated the summary that we listed in order to capture the curiosity and the interest. And a lot of that that you just mentioned is what I'm going to discuss in more detail this evening.
Thank you so much, Doctor. I'd like to ask you a few questions, and I'll start off by asking you, at the end of last week's broadcast, we raised the question, if our liberal progressive leaders are not after truth or justice, as the Kavanaugh hearings and long-running Russian collusion hoax demonstrate, what then are they after? You and others suggest the answer is power. That sounds very ominous. Is this some kind of conspiracy theory, or do you really believe America is on the verge of surrendering her rich tradition of liberty? Is that what this movie, The Moral Storm, is supposed to warn us of, Doctor?
I think so. It's a cautionary tale I think every American in this day and age would do well to heed. The story is set in a quaint Austrian village nestled in the high Alps, not far from the Swiss border. As the curtain rises, village life is idyllic. Viewers are introduced to a wise and warm-hearted professor preaching tolerance, liberal tolerance toward all. It is his great fortune to be surrounded by a loving family, admiring students, and respectful colleagues. Then comes the Nazi occupation, and the world is turned upside down. As students are made to report to class in Nazi uniform, spouting the party line, intolerance toward dissent and everything Jewish reaches into every corner of the popular psyche. Having a smidgen of Jewish blood himself, the mild-mannered professor is stripped of his academic post. He's shunned by his students, taken from his family, and sent to prison, where he falls ill and dies. propaganda, indoctrination, and the silencing of all dissent lead a nation, and before long, the whole world, to ruin. For James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, the stars of the movie, trapped in a world gone stark raving mad with intolerance and a full-throttled suspicion of free thought, there was only one escape. They would have to ski across an inhospitable alpine pass to neutral Switzerland. The trek does not end well. One who lived through the Nazis' early rise to power explained on an internet post not too many years ago what the early days were like. Here's how he described it. Very few people were true Nazis, but many enjoyed the return of German pride, and many more were too busy to care. I was one of those who just thought the Nazis were a bunch of fools. So the majority just sat back and let it all happen. Then before we knew it, they owned us, and we had lost control, and the end of the world had come. End quote.
Wow. That's a very disturbing story.
As I say, I recommend it to everyone, indeed.
I also, while we're on the air, want to apologize to all of those who were affected by the Holocaust. I think it's something that we should always keep in our hearts and minds, and we should always pray for those who lost their lives and who are less fortunate than us today. Doctor, as a result of you just describing the story, are you trying to say that these are the early days of some developing tyranny that will one day overtake America? Or worse, could it be later than we think?
Well, I have to admit the thought seems preposterous, doesn't it? We have a strong democracy, free elections, separation of powers, checks and balances, freedom of the press. We're all perfectly free to speak our minds, elect who we please, and protest what we don't approve. None of this suggests that liberty is under blistering assault right now.
I guess we do have to assume our liberties are perfectly safe and that tyranny is nowhere in view. Thank God for those separation of powers, the checks and balances, and the constitutional protections the founders established all those years ago. It gets one wondering, though, how did those blessed liberty-preserving arrangements come to be, Doctor?
That brings us to the critical lesson the founders themselves left behind for posterity, for all of us. The reason power had to be separated into a legislative branch, an executive branch, and a judicial branch is so that power could be made a check on power's own aggressive designs. One of the least appreciated aspects of the founders' frame of mind by July 4th, 1776, was its deep suspicion of power's awful influence on human affairs. It is from that perspective that they interpreted relations between the 13 colonies and an imperial motherland. It is on that basis that they fought a brutal war of independence, then assembled in Philadelphia in 1787 to compose the U.S. Constitution and start the world over again. Americans were among the most educated citizens in the world. They studied the lessons of history and let those lessons light their path. It taught them that power was the unmistakable, ever-present, age-old nemesis of liberty. Again and again, they learned of free societies that had succumbed to its alluring veneer. Corruption, once underway, they knew, invariably spread until every freedom was wiped permanently off the map. This is the frame of mind through which they interpreted all the events that were taking place during what historians call the Imperial Crisis.
Wow, that is a lot to take in. Could you give us some examples of how they felt and how was the fear of power manifested in the thought of that time?
Okay. In order to do that, I have to say something about a little-known work that circulated throughout the 13 colonies during the 18th century. It was actually composed between the years 1720 and 1723, decades earlier, by two Englishmen. They were John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon. They published 144 essays on liberty, civil and religious. That's what the essays were called. They were then culled together, those 144 essays, and published in four volumes under the title Cato's Letters. And they were immediately devoured by the American colonists. Cato's Letters became the most widely read work the founders consulted as the imperial crisis evolved. Cato's Letters actually was a marriage of John Locke's natural rights, social contract philosophy, of Montesquieu's principles of politics, and of one other rich intellectual tradition. That was the suspicion of power and suspicion of all those who seek it. What I want to do now, Chauncey, is in order to give our listeners a flavor of Trenchard's and Gordon's sense of things, which quickly became the American sense of things and suspicion of power, I'd like to read from various portions of those 144 essays. So,
please.
Trenchard and Gordon write, quote, "The world is governed by men, and men by their passions, which being boundless and insatiable are always terrible when they are not controlled. Who was ever satisfied with riches or power or honors?" They go on, "Men are never satisfied with their present condition, which is never perfectly happy, and perfect happiness being their chief aim and always out of their reach, they are restlessly grasping at what they can never attain." And they go on, quote, "There is nothing so terrible but human nature is capable of it. Men seldom or never stop at certain degrees of mischief when they have power to go further, but hurry on from wickedness to wickedness as far and as fast as human malice can prompt human power." And so they give power and liberty this position of being age-old nemesis, one against the other. And they say, quote, "Power is naturally active, vigilant, and distrustful, which qualifies it in push to upon all means and expedients to fortify itself. It would do what it pleases and have no check. Now, because liberty chastises and shortens power, therefore power would extinguish liberty, and consequently liberty has too much cause to be exceedingly jealous and always upon her defense." It's exactly why Thomas Jefferson counseled that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Typical of Jefferson, he's able to reduce this entire frame of mind to one very pregnant adage. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Cato, in all of these four volumes, dwells endlessly on the loss of liberty in lands near and far. Much like Machiavelli, he discusses in endless detail the cunning practice of corrupt princes and ministers. And so he concludes, quote, "Let us look round this great world and behold what an immense majority of the whole race of men crouch under the yoke of a few tyrants, naturally as low as the meanest of them, and by being tyrants worse than the worst. Let us therefore grow wise by the misfortune of others. Let their virtues and their vices and the punishment of them too be an example to us, and so prevent our miseries from being an example to other nations. And fine, let us examine and look narrowly into every part of our Constitution and see if any corruptions or abuses have crept or galloped into it. So I think this gives our listeners a sense of how suspicious, how, if you will, paranoid the founders were. And this is how they interpreted all of the events, so that a minor imposition of a tea tax or a glass tax or a stamp tax was interpreted in terms of what would be the next tax. How would a tax of 3 pence become a tax of £3 in time if it was not resisted? This was their sense of the world and of the treacherous position that England was created, both the King George III and the Parliament. This is what they were reacting against. This is why they gathered the militia. This is why they began their committees of correspondence, eventually the First Continental Congress, then the Second Continental Congress, to figure out what had to be done against the threat that power posed. And so when it was time for them to create their own government, they had to separate power, make power a check on itself, introduce a written constitution with guaranteed protections for liberty. This is exactly how we have the kind of country that we have.
Doc, I just want to share with our listeners, you are listening to U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Chauncey Brown, my co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler. This is part two of Why Liberal Leaders Lie. We thank you for listening, and please continue, Doctor.
Okay, now, this is what they believed was true. This is the reality of things, that power has such a baleful influence on human affairs, and that it's something that every citizen who cares to preserve his or her liberty must take into account. Well, you ask the question, if this is true, if this is true of reality, if this is true of human nature, then it's true in all times and all places, all periods of human history. Well, let's look around the world today. Is there anything in today's world that teaches that these suspicions are warranted, that human beings who care for liberty have every reason to do their all to preserve and protect the liberties that they enjoy, and to make sure that there are no encroachments that are creeping in, and that government isn't growing exponentially at the sacrifice of liberty? Well, look around the world. Look at China. And the dictators who've occupied government in that land. Look at the Soviet Union, from Lenin to Stalin, on and on, to Putin today. Look at Venezuela with Hugo Chavez and his totalitarian state that he created, and now his successor holding on to power at all costs and suppressing liberty, suppressing even the desire of Western countries to send desperately needed foodstuff to Venezuela, which he won't even let in. So tight a control has Nicolas Maduro, Hugo Chavez's successor, have on government. Look all around the world. Look at the North Vietnam. Look at North Korea with three generations of Kims holding totalitarian control over their people. This is not some kind of dramatic pronouncement. What the founders were saying over 200 years ago describes the world we live in today, that power, in fact, is such a threat, such a danger. And we have to ask, what on earth is it about America that would prevent power thirsty individuals from seeking power and seeking a threat on our liberty. Now, I should say that next week, what we're going to discuss, Chauncey, is how the psychological factors, what is it about the human psychology that drives this age-old thirst for power that so threatens liberty? We will also discuss next week the danger that power now poses to American liberty these times. My recommendation to our listeners and to the whole country is that we would do well to retrieve the founders' awesome suspicion of ever-expanding political power and the threat that such an expansion poses to our liberties today. Those are some of the things that we're going to be discussing next time. But I would beseech our listeners to look carefully for themselves between now and our gathering next week at this telltale signs of power's threat to liberties, how our liberties are being shortened, are being threatened by government's growing power, and especially our liberal progressives who are recommending all kinds of liberty-striking, liberty-reducing policies that they would impose. And we're going to discuss them in greater length next week.
So, Doctor, if I may attempt to summarize briefly what's going on in part one and part two, are you saying that liberals or progressive, those individuals who want to provide us with free things, is really consequently putting us in the position of being controlled by our government and taking our liberties away?
I would say that is very well put and very accurate. In other words, we know that government really doesn't produce anything, so government itself cannot provide anything. Originally,
exactly.
Government was designed to protect every individual in the enjoyment of their rights. Of course, that did not include African slaves, and it did not include women. They had a much narrower understanding of what human nature is. But that notwithstanding, the fact is the purpose of government was to protect the liberties of the individual. But government soon became more than a protector. It became a provider. Government decided that it was its job to promote national greatness, to promote economic growth. But it can only do that, as we discussed in our series on capitalism and socialism, government can only provide material assistance, provide benefits to some, by denying that material assistance to others. Most simply, it taxes some individuals in order to benefit others, and it's no longer a protector, it becomes a provider, but it can provide to some Americans only by depriving other Americans of their rights and of their freedoms. And that's how government growth began.
Now, let me ask you another question. Did government, or I should say, was the people who have created these policies, did they do this as a result? The government created political greed, corporate greed, and individual greed by these leaders, the three
greeds.
Well,
I would say that government doesn't create greed. Greed is always there. Like we discussed when we were talking about capitalism a few weeks back, there are two kinds of capitalists. there is the capitalist who was quite willing to accept the risks that the free market offers. You can't avoid them if you're a capitalist. You don't know who's going to come in with a new invention that is going to make your old invention obsolete. There are always risks. However, there are other kinds of capitalists, who we would call greedy capitalists, who would much prefer to avoid the risks by running to government for subsidies or special licensing arrangements that would reduce or even eliminate the risks for them, but of course at their competitors' expense, at others' expense. In other words, if I'm a what I call a counterfeit capitalist, I would run to government for subsidies or special monopoly privileges, and that would almost guarantee my profits. But it means that if you're not part of the monopoly, you are not even allowed to do business. And if you're a company paying taxes so that I can get my subsidies, again, my subsidies are had at others' expense. That, as we said, is not laissez-faire capitalism, certainly, but it is how government began to grow, because the so-called capitalists themselves wanted to avoid the normal market risks, ran to government, and this introduces corruption into society. And once it's introduced, as the founders well understood, corruption just grows and grows and grows at liberty's expense.
Doctor, thank you very much for that brief summary. And for all our listeners, this is U.S. National Politics. In our prior shows at U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio, you could hear further discussions about the difference between capitalism and socialism. We are at the end of our show today. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to U.S. National Politics of Part 2, Why Liberal Leaders Lie. I want to thank our co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler, for his insight into why liberal leaders lie and why the country of America is in the current state that it is. I'm asking everyone to please join us again next Tuesday at 6 o'clock for Why Liberal Leaders Lie, Part 3. Dr. Hyler did share a brief snippet on what will be next week about the mindset of these leaders, and I'm looking forward to that show as well. In closing, Dr. Hyler, would you like to say something?
Well, again, my recommendation is that really we lose our sense of complacence, our sense of apathy, our sense that all is well. As we're going to discover next week, through a lot of recent developments in our culture, political correctness, campus speech codes, the meaning of the Green New Deal, on and on and on, the threat that all of those developments pose to our liberties if we don't reverse course and do it pretty quickly.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hyler. Once again, U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio Show, we want to thank our listeners. And remember, every day our liberty is in jeopardy. We must all consider and reconsider the liberties, the leaders that we choose, because they may compromise our liberty. Thanks again, Dr. Hyler. I always enjoy doing the show with you, and I look forward to doing the show with you on next Tuesday. God bless you all, and we'll see you 6 p.m. next Tuesday, Why Leaders, Liberal Leaders Lie, Part 3. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.